There's something that's going on in the way that we live our lives and where we play and where we buy our food, in the types of food that we're able to buy, that is causing this epidemic. And it's not just our community. It's not just Baldwin Park. It's everywhere. How many of us know one person in our family with diabetes? How about two? Three? Keep your hand. It used to be that type 2 diabetes only affected adults. And now it's affecting children at epidemic proportions.
If you didn't know you could be scared of a chicken nugget, you might be in for an awakening when you hear about the new documentary Food, Inc. The film follows up on the rise in food consciousness jump-started by books like Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation and Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma, and does its best to get at the truth of the massive agribusiness producers generating most of our nation's food. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're joined by Robert Kenner, a producer and director of the documentary Food, Inc., and he's an award-winning film and television screenwriter, director, and producer, whose films include Lonely Hearts and John Brown's Holy War. In 2005, Kenner produced and directed the Vietnam War documentary called 2 Days in October, which won the award for exceptional merit in nonfiction filmmaking at the 2006 Emmy Awards. And we have an open door for your calls this morning, too. Are you prepared to pay more for food that's local and produced on a smaller scale? And how concerned are you with where our food comes from and who's making it? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. And Robert Kenner, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Delight to be here.
Well, your new documentary, Food, Inc., focuses on the transformation of the American food industry from more small-scale local producers to a handful, really, of these mega agribusiness producers. Where did you get the sense that that change came from? How did it happen?
Well, I think the transformation started about 40, 50 years ago, soon after the Second World War. And it really got sort of propelled forward with the birth of fast food. McDonald's wanted hamburgers that tasted the same, so for them it was difficult having 50 meat producers buying cattle from 50 different places, so they started to want to centralize, and they basically sort of started to buy from 3 or 4 cattle processors, and then they wanted potatoes, so ultimately they started buying from one source, and then it was tomatoes, and then it was lettuce, and now McDonald's is the biggest buyer of not only cattle and chicken, but they're one of the biggest buyers of lettuce and tomatoes and apples. So they want centralized sources, and those centralized sources started to then feed our supermarkets. So we have fewer and fewer producers of food at this point.
How many are there? Can you name some names?
Well, you know, ultimately, everything's become centralized. So when you go into the supermarket and you see all those different brand names, they're generally owned by other, by large corporations. There's a few meat packers, there's a few chicken, people in the chicken industry. And, you know, when we started in the 50s, I think they were like something like, I've forgotten the exact numbers at this point, but it was something like 8 or 10 that made up 50% of the people who produced our beef. And then when we made the film, it was something like 4 companies produced something over 80%. And since we've made the film in the last year, it looks like it's going to be 3 companies that make up almost 85%.
3 companies make up 85%?
Of the beef.
Of the beef.
Each area has, 2 or 3 different companies.
So this is a trend that's continuing.
It continues. There's a real sense of centralization that's going on. And it keeps narrowing down. But it's not only the corporations, it's also what kind of... we have one type of corn, or we have one type of tomato, and ultimately our food has been totally transformed in the last 40, 50 years without us sort of noticing the changes. And that's what's so interesting, that the cattle are not grown out on the range. They're grown in massive feedlots. The chickens are grown in huge football-size basically areas with no light and no fresh air, and these chickens grow super fast and they can't, you know, stand under their own weight because we grow them so much bigger. But it's not only the animals, it's the, you know, the vegetables. Some of them are genetically modified. They're being sprayed with all these pesticides, and there are fewer and fewer varieties. But ultimately, it's also us. We've been transformed. We're eating 300 more calories per day, and we're ultimately not getting the nutrition, and it's starting. We have very inexpensive food, which is really a wonderful thing, but unfortunately, there are many hidden costs to this inexpensive food, and they're starting to show up, and it's going to cost us.
Well, you can see why these food producers would say, you know, what's your problem? We're doing our job right. We're doing it incredibly efficiently. We're doing it quickly, and we're doing it cheaply, which would seem to benefit people on the outset, but you're saying that's not at all the case, or at least there's a deeper cost there.
Yeah. Well, the answer is it is the case. We are producing food cheaper than at any point in probably the history of the world. We're putting less of our paycheck towards food. The problem is it's on a number of levels it's costing us. You know, the biggest is health. 64% of Americans are either overweight or obese, and more of them are obese than overweight.
Why is that down to the food producers?
Well, because we're putting in massive amounts of sugar, salt, and fat into this food, incredible amounts. And these are things that we as humans crave. We're genetically designed to want this food. But if you started to see, you know, like if you just put the sugar that you eat per day, if you go to eat out or you buy processed food or you see the salt, I mean, I was just reading the other day that was one of the chains, I forget which, has a hamburger that has three times the amount of salt we're supposed to eat in a day. So, and then if you have other things that are thrown in, just that meal could be a week's worth of salt. And we're designing food at this point that's not good for us. And it also doesn't have, as I say, it doesn't have the nutrition. So that's one aspect that's costing us, and you don't see it at the checkout counter. You know, the fact is we can't have a new healthcare system in this country until we can get food under control that's making, you know, makes us healthy, doesn't make us sick. But it's also, it's an unsustainable system.
How so?
That it's based on gasoline, it's based on oil, and it's also based on pollution. So these are things that ultimately are finite, and we're going to run out of it. So,
you're talking about food, like transporting a tomato from California to New England.
Well, it's both. It's 20. I think it's 20%, 20 to 25% of all our energy costs go into the growing and transporting of our food system. So it's taking up a tremendous amount of energy, and it's also it doesn't taste as good. That's the other thing. It doesn't taste as good.
And from what I hear from things you've said in the film, the tomato that we're eating is not really tomato as nature intended. What's give me an example with the tomato there.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's, I don't know, you know, what we say, it's become a notional tomato. What's happened is we want things to look shiny and pretty, and we don't want them to go bad, and we don't want them to bruise. So we design a type of tomato that will last, but it doesn't have nutritional value. It doesn't have flavor, but it does have these other things. So, you know, it's a trade-off. But I think we've gone a little too far in one direction. So, I mean, I think we have amazing farmers in this country that are doing great things. It's just that we as consumers have to start asking and demanding, and we have a power, and that's one of the stories in Food Inc., is that we as consumers have a lot more power than we think we do to start getting the food that we need and should be getting.
When you say we have power as consumers, do you mean with what we buy, with our money, or are there other things we should be doing?
Yeah. Well, to begin with our money, as we say in Food Inc., you get to vote three times a day, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And if we can start to change, you know, even if it's one of our meals, one of the things is we're not perfect. And if you think you have to be perfect, it becomes so overwhelming in making your food choices that it's easy to forget about it. So if you can just change one little meal and start to eat with your eyes open and start to think about, where does your food come from? Is this fair food? Fair meaning, is it fair to the people growing it, you know, who make it, the workers? Is it fair to the animals? Is it fair to the earth? And is it good for us? Will it make us healthy? So that in our votes three times a day, if we can start to think about what we're eating, where it's coming from, and it's hard. We're all so busy. We don't have a lot of time. But, you know, if we can get to farmers markets, you're going to start to get a lot better. You know, the food's going to be a lot healthier, a lot fresher, and it's going to have been grown in a good way. So we advocate just trying to think about it, trying to encourage a few, you know, better choices, and it's going to force people to start growing better food.
Well, tell us about a few stories from the film that you uncovered. I read about one, actually, where you had gotten news from someone who worked in poultry manufacturing that a certain chicken manufacturer was using arsenic in their chicken feed. Now, that didn't make the film, because I gather it was hard to communicate with some of these big producers. But is that typical of what you found, and what happened in that case?
Well, that was... It's something I haven't talked about much, so you've done good research there. It was an example where it was Purdue who had been using arsenic because it helps the chickens grow faster. And I spent a lot of time trying to get inside the world of chickens and find somebody who grows chickens for industrial, for the Tysons and the Purdues of the world, and probably spoke to, you know, 100 producers, but they were all scared to let me in. They wanted to let me in, but they knew they would do so at great consequence, even though they owned their, what we'll call farms in quotation marks. They owned it, but they still knew they could lose the right to get these chickens if they let us in. And once you lose the right with one or two of these companies, you're basically, you don't have any choice and you lose your livelihood. And the problem for the chicken farmers is they've spent so much money building these chicken houses that they can't, they're in debt. They're in hundreds of thousands of debt. So they, you know, they have to be very careful. So finally I found one chicken producer who allowed me in, and she knew by allowing me in, she did so at great peril, and it turns out she's lost her contract as she expected. But she told me they use arsenic in their feed, and we kept going back and forth to all the industrial food makers wanting them to come in, and we'd tell them who we're talking to, what we're talking about, and Purdue said, well, you know, even though they defended using arsenic within a month of our interviewing the chicken farmer, they said, well, we stopped using it the day before your interview, so you shouldn't be using that. And I chose to take it out of the film because, you know, one is I'm a bit nervous about talking about food in this country is a very dangerous thing. There are laws designed to make it very easy to be sued. They're called veggie libel laws. And Oprah was sued when she had somebody on her show talking about how it makes you think twice about eating a hamburger during the mad cow disease. She was sued and spent 6 years in court and over $1 million because she disparaged a food product. And I don't quite have the same deep pockets Oprah has, so it's a real concern. And I found myself occasionally censoring myself so, you know, to err on the safe side, and dealt with lawyers, you know, amazing amount of time with lawyers, because food turns out to be a very contentious subject.
Well, John Stewart, keeping in the track of poultry manufacturing, John Stewart called it the Abu Ghraib of poultry manufacturing. Is that a fair statement, what you saw?
Well, I think, you know, it's when you go in and see how our food is produced, you know, it's surprising.
Well, what did you see? Describe it for us.
Yeah, houses, you know, a little larger than the size of football fields. There are about 25 to 30,000 chickens crammed in. Basically, a modern chicken house has no light. It has no open windows. The chickens are placed there. It gets so crowded they can't move. And they're designed to grow a lot bigger and a lot faster. And, you know, we have a system that's very efficient. Things grow quick and big. And, but it's a strange system because it's when you see this, you know, it's not very appetizing. But that's just chickens. I think it goes all the way across the board. I mean, I saw strawberries being grown where people have to stand out in spacesuits to spray them because if anything touches their bodies, they're going to get poisoned. So ultimately, do we want to be eating it? It's not just the animals. This is not a film that says you should be a vegetarian. It's a film that says we should be conscious of the dangers of this industrialized system that on one hand is bringing us very inexpensive food, but there are costs connected to it.
You just scared me with the strawberries thing. I love strawberries.
Yeah.
So you say you saw people in hazmat suits because of the chemicals?
Yeah. There's a great website that your listeners should know about called The Dirty Dozen, because there are a number of vegetables and fruits that you really shouldn't be eating unless they're organic. And there are other vegetables and fruits that you can eat that aren't organic, though I'm sure it's better to do it organic in terms of the earth. But there's some that are just, you don't want to feed to your children. So if you go to the Dirty Dozen site, it'll tell you which ones really to avoid. But yeah, I had hoped to actually film a hazmat suit fashion show. I thought that would be great, but like everything else in the world of food, it was really hard to gain access. And I thought if I went to the actual people who designed the suits, I might have a chance of getting in and avoid the food companies themselves. But unfortunately, I didn't succeed.
Well, there's so much to talk about here, but we have to take a quick break right now. And then we'll come back and keep talking about the new documentary Food Inc. with its producer and director, Robert Kenner, who is an award-winning film and television screenwriter, director, and producer. And, of course, we welcome your calls as well. I don't know if you've seen the movie yet. It is out. I think it opened in late June. And what you thought of it, and what do you think? Would you be willing to pay more for food that's locally produced? Or is the bottom line the bank book? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, join Larry Mueller to talk about clean energy technologies. Many of them are being called game-changing. Larry's guest is Jim Sims with the Western Business Roundtable.
The irony is that the average consumer does not feel very powerful. They think that they are the recipients of whatever industry has put out there for them to consume. Trust me, it's the exact opposite. When we run an item past the supermarket scanner, we're voting for local or not, organic or not.
At Walmart, we made a decision about a year ago to go through a process of becoming RBST-free in our milk supply. We made that decision based on customer preference.
Individual consumers changed the biggest company on earth, and in so doing, probably put the last nail in the coffin for synthetic growth hormone.
Interesting there, Robert Kenner. Walmart took bovine growth hormone out of its milk?
It's an unusual... We'd been trying so hard to reach all the industrial food producers and the large corporations and wanting to have all the voices heard in this film and try to do a fair, you know, trying to answer the question, how's the food get to our table? You know, as I say, on one hand, we spend less for it than at any time in history, which is great, but it's coming to us at this high cost, and sort of tried to understand it. And I worked really hard and just kept getting refused by one food maker or one supplier after another. And then at the last second, the one company that came in was Walmart. You know, and I was so stunned. And in the midst of filming with them, they made this announcement. They were going to stop buying milk with RBST, which is a growth hormone that's given to the dairy cattle that make them produce about 20% more milk per cow. And, I realized, you know, we as consumers do have power. And that was, you heard Gary Hirschberg's voice, who's from Stonyfield Yogurt. And, he was arguing that, you know, he thinks it's important that we do sell to the Walmarts, even though he gets attacked by some people. You know, we all know things that Walmart has done in the past that we, you know, might not be happy with. At the same time, you can try to, as a consumer, try to get these companies to switch and start doing what we need to have done to start to provide us healthier food. And there, Walmart actually chose to get rid of RBST. And when they did, Monsanto, who does not play a very good role in this film, chose to sell their unit because they realized it was no longer going to be profitable, even though they still are suing, or they had been suing farmers who said their milk was free of RBST right up until the point that they sold their company, which is, I think, one of the big challenges in this world. But it's so when we finally did get to talk to a large, you know, Walmart certainly is important for the industrialization of the system, but they're also starting to become very helpful in trying to make it a much more sustainable system. And we wanted to encourage companies who are starting to do the right things and wanted to show that consumers can help change them.
I want to go to the phone lines now. We've got Ralph waiting to talk to you from Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I kind of made the call before the conversation, and so maybe I'm saying something that isn't going to be discussed. But one thing that, you know, a lot of people talk about, especially when they're talking about diabetes too, is they make the comment that people, poor people, buy from fast food places because it costs them less than if they buy food at the store. And I'm not quite sure where that comes from, because I'm sure if you go to McDonald's with a family of four, you're going to spend $15 to $20 for one meal. And you should be able to prepare your own meal for half that cost. I think really what it is it's laziness, and it's going to be hard to change that because people are going to do what's the most convenient thing to do. And it also goes with the cost thing. You know, if someone is going to the store and they're going to pay twice as much for organic food, they're just not going to buy the organic food. Now, the people that are more affluent will spend that money, but I think the only way you're going to get, you know, abuse of the system is if the FDA starts getting some toughness to it and actually does enforce some of the food safety things. As far as the manufacturer is concerned, I'm afraid that the lowest cost producer is going to be the one that's going to end up with most of the business, because that's just kind of how it is.
Great.
Well,
thanks, Ralph.
Really interesting question. I think in the film we show a very low-income Latino family who work long, long hours. They leave their house before 7 and they get home around 9, 10 o'clock. And we show them going to a fast food meal, which costs them $11 for a ton of food for four people. Are buying this meal, and then they go shopping. One of the problems is that the fast food meal and the processed food in the supermarket is being subsidized by you and I and the federal government because we're subsidizing corn and soy. And these are the things that are making us fat, and these are the things that are making us sick and are leading to the diabetes crisis. There was a little girl in the film who wanted to buy a bunch of, it was pears or something like that, and they were very expensive compared to some processed item, and they ended up, they couldn't afford the healthy food at that point in the market. And, I think one of the things is not only do we vote with our forks, we also have to vote with our votes and hopefully try to end subsidies that are, you know, not encouraging healthy food. I do agree with you. One is capable of cooking and doing it for a little less money. It does mean you need a little more time to do it, and everything in our society has gotten faster, and we do, I don't know if it's lazy or, you know, it's just everything has gotten more difficult to spend time, but certainly the best food you're going to get is staying at home and cooking with your family and your friends. It's going to have a lot less salt and sugar and fat, and I think, you know, certainly the thing that we try to encourage. I think, you know, so hopefully if we can change subsidies, we can start to make a fair system. That's one of the things that we encourage. And I would just say, Ralph, the thing is that this family in the film that couldn't afford the healthy food, the father is spending $500 a month on diabetes medicine, and the 13-year-old daughter looks like she's pre-diabetic. And if she ends up there, it could be a fortune in health care costs. And the staggering statistic is one out of every three Americans born after the year 2000 will have early-onset diabetes. So the fact of the matter is this, you know, inexpensive food is going to start to cost us too much. So hopefully, you know, we will start to encourage healthier food. I do think the FDA, by the way, is starting. We've screened the film in Washington. We've screened a very high up-level officials. And they said, if there's a movement, we will follow. At which point, I think it was Eric Schlosser responded, well, you don't need to follow in terms of food safety. And there have been announcements and their bills going through to help give the FDA the right to sort of start to regulate and start to help create safer food.
Based on what Ralph said about thinking of people as being lazy, I wonder how much of the problems with food and what we eat are also wrapped up in things which are just cultural, sort of maybe cultural to America, the fact that our tempo of life is so fast and we work so many hours and we work so hard. It's not only that the food is cheaper, it's that we don't have time to prepare right. This other food, and we're not taught how to incorporate that into our lives.
I think it's certainly that we're just going faster and faster, and that's certainly definitely part of the problem. We have to figure out how to reverse this if we're going to survive. But just remember this, what we call, this food system that we have now, it's only been around for 40, 50 years at the most. This is all brand new. Your grandparents would not know most of the things when you walk through a supermarket. They wouldn't have, you know, or my grandparents, who are not alive, wouldn't have recognized this as being food. There are all those strange words on the packages. Those didn't exist 30, 40 years ago. And that's corn and soy, which is being subsidized by the government.
Let's take another phone call. Now we've got Cynthia joining us from St. Paul. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. It's a pleasure to talk on this subject, and I'm looking forward to seeing the movie Food, Inc. I think when the gentleman mentioned being lazy, I think it's a matter of discipline. It's very difficult to change a behavior, whether it's spending your money in the wrong places or shopping too much. Certainly buying the right foods is important, and it's cheaper to buy organic than it is to pay for diabetes, than it is to pay for cancer. And because our culture is sicker and sicker and fatter, it is important that we pay attention to what big corporations are feeding us, because if the chicken is getting arsenic poisoning, then our children are getting arsenic poisoning. And we can find these things in our body just by doing a test to find out how many poisons and toxins that have come into our body through the environment and through the food that we eat. Now, I'm a raw foodist, so I'm a little on the extreme side. I eat and prepare only raw organic foods because my family is a very sick family, ranging from diabetes, heart disease, cancers of all kinds. And I'm an African-American also, which means that the choices of the foods in the areas where I live are very poor. Poor quality, you can't find a fresh apple. And so I have to go to a large extent out of the way to find organic foods, but it is worth it in order that I can reverse any of the damages that I already have, not to mention age-related illnesses that occur. So it's cheaper to buy organic and spend the extra money than it is to pay for a disease.
All right, so, thanks for your thoughts, Cynthia. I appreciate that.
And Cynthia, I was just going to say that, you know, it's one out of every two minority Americans who are going to have early onset diabetes. And these food companies really target lower income areas now because they know people are busy. They don't have the time. And it reminds me so much of what happened with tobacco. And I think the parallels are very important. The food companies are so strong, so powerful. The tobacco companies were so strong, so powerful. They both have incredible connections to government. We show in the film there are these revolving doors of people going back and forth from companies to government, getting large raises, ruling on the things they had been part of, working on it when they were in the food corporations. But what happens is that these, you know, like tobacco, which said their product was not bad for you, and they had studies that prove that tobacco wasn't bad that were sponsored by the food by the tobacco companies. I think, you know, we're having more and more information starting to leak out about the health of our food, and I think, like tobacco, we're going to start to see through it and demand changes. And the fact is, we did change tobacco laws in this country. I think they just put out a law saying you have to list what's in our cigarettes now. Hopefully one day they'll have to list what's in our food.
There was a lot of litigation involved in the dismantling of the tobacco industry or the rearranging of it. Are we going to see litigation with food as well?
Well, there's starting to be lawsuits, but the difference is these food companies have watched what happened with tobacco. So on one hand, there's like David Kessler, who's the former head of the FDA, who was appointed by George Bush Sr., and then worked under Clinton as well in the FDA. He has a book called The End of Overeating, and he talks about the dangers of this food system and how they are designing foods to make us sick. They know that, but they know you will buy it. And it sounds so similar to tobacco. But I think that ultimately it's going to be the consumer who's going to demand change. And it has to be led by us because government, ultimately, these people are scared to go against these power interest groups that are in Washington. So it's the only thing we can do is scare them with our votes.
One of the issues on the table now, I gather, is the labeling of genetically modified and cloned food, meat for that matter. What's going on in that department?
Well, Veronica, I think that one of the scary moments for me in this film was we were going to a hearing on whether we should be labeling cloned meats. I'm not a food, you know, I've not been obsessed by food issues. I consider myself a rather normal eater, you know, a typical American eater. I didn't know there was cloned meat. I don't know what my position necessarily is on cloned meat other than I would like to be I'd like to know about it and have the right to choose whether I should eat it or not. What happened in this hearing was that someone from the meat industry stood up and said, we don't think it's in the interest of the consumer to know that there's cloned meat in their food. We think it would be just too confusing for them. And it gave me goosebumps because I realized this is happening time and time again. This is happening with genetically modified organisms. 70% of the food in the supermarket contains GMOs, but yet it's not listed on the packages. There's cloned meat, there's trans fats, there's RBST. I mean, with RBST, these companies were suing farmers that said their food didn't contain RBST. So I think these corporations will do everything to not let you know that this food has been transformed and it's changing, and they don't want you to be thinking about it. And what we try to do in Food Inc. is get people to open their eyes to understand there's something very different going on. And we should be thinking about it and should be part of the conversation. And there are things we can do to make it a lot better.
Cloned meat is already banned in the EU, isn't it?
What is that? I'm sorry.
Cloned meat is banned in the EU, isn't it?
I don't. I think it is. And I know, you know, in Europe, GMOs, they're much more strict about GMOs. There are certain things we do better here. There are certain things, a lot of things they do better there. But I think we're not even talking about whether you should ban it. We're talking about that you should
label it,
that we should have the right to know. I'm not, you know, I'm ready to give them the benefit of the doubt. But can't we know? As Americans, if you're going to have a free market, shouldn't it be based on information? And I'm finding that these corporations are saying, no, it shouldn't be based on information. And I think there's something wrong. And that, to me, was the most frightening thing I found out.
Well, it's interesting. We just came through, we're not even through it yet, this era where lack of transparency in government played a pretty big role in leading to the economic collapse that we're in the middle of right now. And it seems as though that sort of same lack of transparency is pretty evident in the food industry.
Well, that's, I mean, listen, this, you know, the whole mortgage thing through the whole, you know, financial, you know, created this incredible financial crisis, and it dropped us off a cliff. And, you know, there were a few reckless people that brought us all down. And I think, or maybe it's more than a few, because we as a society sort of got encouraged to be brought down as well. I think the same thing could happen to food, and that's why we made Food Inc. is to start a conversation. And I was hoping it would be a transparent conversation with all parties. And I didn't start this with a preconceived point of view where I was out to prove people guilty. But it was my last film was done in Madison. Called 2 Days in October, and it was about a Dow demonstration in Madison and an ambush in Vietnam. It was based on a book by David Marinus, They March into Sunlight. And I found that we talked to everybody involved in these incidences. And it was so interesting because I learned so much from people whose points of view were different than mine. And it really made me think about the world differently. And I had hoped to do that in this film. And unfortunately, there was like a veil dropped between me and my food. And these people not only didn't want me to go in their kitchens, and I can understand that to some degree. And when I say the kitchens, I mean the feedlots or the chicken houses or the strawberry fields. But they also didn't want to talk about why they thought this system was good. Occasionally, I would have somebody who would speak. I had a man from the National Chicken Council who said, you know, we grow more chickens on less land for, you know, fewer dollars. What's wrong with that? And I was happy to include that argument in our film. But I was sad to say very, very, very few people would talk to us.
Let's try to get in one more phone call here before we take our break. Karen calling from Richland Center. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show, as usual. I have got so much to say, but I'm going to keep it really as short as possible.
Okay.
I am. I chose a vegetarian lifestyle probably 10 years ago, mainly because I had my eyes opened to factory farming, and I refused to have even a dime of my money going to support that industry. I think it's a nightmare, and I really firmly believe that if the American people really sat down and became a little bit more conscious and saw exactly where their food comes from and how it's produced, they would all, for the most part, follow my lead. But at any rate, I do try and buy organic. I am not one of the affluent. I'm a student. I'm on a very limited budget. And I'm finding that organic produce and organic products are much more readily available than they have been in the past. So as far as the money issue goes, beans and lentils and tomatoes, things like that, they're easily accessible and they don't cost a lot of money, okay, number one. And number two, I'm concerned about what your guest was talking about as far as our produce goes, strawberries, things like that. And I'm wondering, what am I to do? I do shop at my local farmer's market, and I do buy my produce from them when I can. But the point is that, say, in the wintertime, when the farmer's markets aren't available, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to buy good, healthy produce that hasn't been genetically altered or cloned or sprayed with poison? What is the person supposed to do? And thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think, you know, one of the great things, you know, besides organic, I think equally as important, if not even more important, is local, whenever possible. And that means, you know, we've grown so used to, you know, seeing everything in the supermarket all season, you know, all four seasons. We forget that strawberries grow in the summer because they're shipped in from, you know, the southern hemisphere, or asparagus are coming in all year round. We're getting them from North America and South America, and blueberries are coming in from Chile. And so these, you know, foods are being shipped on airplanes. They're being shipped on, you know, large container ships. They don't have flavor. So I think we have to learn to start eating in season again. We can start canning things from your farmer's market. Like right now, we're getting tons of tomatoes here. We're starting to can them when we have time, and they're delicious that way. You know, and you can find some of your stores will have things, you know, that are more local. And there's certain vegetables, by the way, that are not as terrible to eat, that are, you know, if they're not organic. And that's why I say go to the Dirty Dozen site. There are others that you just have to avoid. And then when you go to the supermarket, because we all go to the supermarket, is start to ask them, you know, what do you have that's local? What do you have that's organic? And we need to start encouraging, you know, these mainline distributors to start buying better food. We have a farmer in our film who's growing industrial corn and industrial soy, and he's pleading with us. He's saying, you know, if you want us to grow better food, we'd love to grow it. So I think our farmers are more than capable of starting to grow much healthier food, but we need to start to, you know, demand it of our supermarkets as well.
Let's take another quick break right now and rejoin Robert Kenner in just a moment. He's the producer and director of the documentary Food, Inc. And we're talking about that film today, welcoming your calls at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And coming up this morning at 11:45, Larry Mueller will be in. Who are the first residents of Wisconsin? After 11:45, Larry finds out from Associate Professor of History and Dean at UW Sauk County, Baraboo. I'm Veronica Rickard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I mean, a culture that just views a pig as a pile of protoplasmic inanimate structure to be manipulated by whatever creative design the human can foist on that critter will probably view individuals within its community and other cultures in the community of nations with the same type of disdain and disrespect and controlling type mentality.
A clip there from the documentary we're talking about this morning called Food, Inc. We're talking with the film's director, Robert Kenner, who is its producer and director, and also he's known for John Brown's Holy War and the film 2 Days in October, the Vietnam War documentary, which won the Exceptional Merit in Nonfiction Filmmaking in 2006 at the Emmy Awards. And I want to start by reading an email here from Mike. He says, I have come full circle on this issue. I used to be one of those that thought you could eat anything and be just fine, so the cheaper the better. But now I have my own organic garden, participate in a CSA, and share and use the farmer's market regularly. I am more than happy to pay more for good quality foods now. There is nothing more important, really. Do you see that same attitude creeping across the country, Robert Kenner?
I totally do. I think it's an incredible... I didn't realize that when we were making this film, that we were sort of entering into the middle of an incredible movement that is growing and growing. And, you know, evidenced by Michelle Obama and her recent vegetable garden. And, by the way, I don't know if your listeners know, but she got attacked because she didn't use chemicals. And there was a lot of extreme mail coming to the White House.
I hadn't heard that. What do people object to about not using...
Well, it's not very American to grow vegetables without chemicals because they're saying it's not efficient. And, you know, they took great offense that she was suggesting that she should grow an organic garden. they didn't like that she, you know, her garden didn't use those chemicals. And I think that, again, is an example of... You know, what they call conventional food is factory food, chemical food, and it's only been around for 40 years, but that's become what we call conventional. And what we're saying in this film is it's not going to last. It can't keep going because we can't, you know, in many states, you can't even drink the water for 6 months of the year. The earth itself is being robbed of the nutrients. So it's all going to end like the financial crisis very quickly. So hopefully we can start to think of alternatives sooner than later and start to spend money that's not designed to prove that the system we have now works, but trying to find a system that really will work and keeping an open mind.
Let's take another call now. We've got Jill from Madison. Welcome, Jill.
Hi, thank you. Robert, I am a huge fan and advocate for the film and just the mission that you and everybody has, you know, contributed to trying to change people's lives. I rep a food product line that is just about this. We try to educate people. I go into women's homes, and I try to educate them and get them to understand that just because they walk into a grocery store doesn't mean that everything on that shelf is okay. And even though the FDA has approved, you know, what's sitting on that shelf doesn't mean that it's good for them and that they are the gatekeepers for their children's health. And they have to learn to read labels, and they have to understand what it is that they are putting in their bodies. And a lot of them say, well, you know, it's all about cost. The higher, you know, food costs, we can't afford. And I said, well, where do you want to pay for it? Because you're either going to pay for it in the beginning and have a healthier, you know, lifestyle and pocketbook, because you're not going to be paying for health care costs at the end, you know, when you're turning 50 and 60 and the entire family is coming down with diabetes, heart disease, or cancer. It's these preservatives are building up in our systems or causing inflammation, which is the root of all the disease that is affecting this country and this population. People, they're uneducated. They just take for granted because of convenience that, you know, it's on the market. It's okay for us.
Well, I think what you're saying is really important, Jill. But I would step back and say it's not even that they're uneducated. It's that these companies are spending billions of dollars to keep us this way. You know, you go into the supermarket, there are all these images of red barns and white picket fences. And, you know, we're being, people are spending fortunes, or these companies are spending fortunes, to continue the myth that nothing has happened with our food system when it's fundamentally different. And it's costing us. So I think you're right. You know, these labels, these things didn't exist 30, 40, 50 years ago. These words, you know, we've just come up with these words, and it's not good for us, and it's going to cost us. And it's going to cost us beyond our health. I mean, it's on numbers of levels. You know, what kind of a society is it? I'll step back for a second and say, you can tell a lot by a society by how they grow their food. I think Eric said this in Fast Food Nation, where the Roman Republic, you know, they had their citizen farmers growing their food. The Roman Empire had slaves. The American Revolution was fought by citizen farmers. Today, we have illegal immigrants who are now growing and processing the vast majority of our food. It's because these jobs are dangerous. It's because these jobs are, you know, very, very low pay. And it's because these people have no right to say anything that we use them to grow and process the food. And as Joe Saladin, that wonderful farmer who you just heard talking about the protoplasmic pig, saying if you treat animals that way, you'll start to treat people that way, and you'll start to treat your community that way. And I think that's what's happened. It's like our food is no longer fair to the people making it, to the people, you know, to the earth, to the, you know, to the animals, and to us. So we need fair food on so many levels. Not, you know, our health being perhaps the most important to all of us, but I think it goes way beyond that.
Well, thanks for that call, Jill. And let's try to squeak in one last call from Tim in East Troy. Hi, Tim.
Thanks for picking my call.
Sure.
I want to weigh in as a young farmer, a certified organic vegetable grower, just to inform people that with the economy being rough and jobs being scarce, there's a real opportunity for growth for people who are perhaps ambitious or don't know what they want to do with their lives, to start growing food and to make lives out of that. So if you never quite grew up and got the 9-to-5 job looking for something to do, I'd really look into trying to do some market gardening and growing and reach out to people to do that. But the main reason I called was there's been a lot of fuss recently over bills bottled up and coming out of committee. There's one currently, H.R. 2749, the Food Safety and Enhancement Act. Under the guise of food safety, which I think we would all agree is really important, there are some interesting things being put through out of committees that could have some serious repercussions, possibly, on especially small growers. So I wondered if your guest had any knowledge of that or any feelings about how he thinks Congress people balance food safety with, you know, potentially some pretty disastrous effects for small farmers through mm-hmm. legislation coming up.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Tim. Robert Kenner?
Yeah,
and
I'm
we've got about a minute left.
H.R. 875, I think, is the bill that I know about, which, again, you know, one of the things is they were saying how smaller farmers have to label, they have to code each chicken as where someone with the 30,000 chicken house could, you know, have one tag for all 30,000 chickens. And obviously that's not fair. And I think the way the rules, you know, the way it worked in Washington is things tend to favor larger producers. I spoke to a few senators and congresspeople, some of whom are in the film, and was saying on one hand, I think the food safety bills that are coming up are incredibly good, but there's the danger that they keep favoring big business. So I think what the last caller was saying is a very important thing, though the few congresspeople I spoke to said they are really taking measures to try to correct that. I know if you're under a certain size, you're not part of it, so you fall out of it. So it becomes sort of these mid-level wonderful producers who should not, you know, I think that we have to work hard towards protecting them.
And Robert, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We could talk all day on this, but we're out of time.
Well, hopefully people will go see Food Inc., and, you know, we're really looking to open people's eyes to a system that needs to be changed and to be thought about.
And we wish you well with it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed it.
Robert Kenner is the producer and director of the documentary Food Inc. Thank you to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to Brittany DeAnda for answering your phone calls this morning. I'm Veronica Rickert, thanking you for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.